uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. We'll technically call this the Tuesday broadcast because, hey, it doesn't count till you go to sleep, right? But we are officially smack dab into Tuesday, into Wednesday now, 22nd into the 23rd of March 2011. So glad you could join us here tonight. And I was on tonight for 3 hours with Lee Rogers tonight, and so thanks again to Lee for having me on over there. Generally, I don't do shows the same day as I'm on with Lee. Sometimes I'll do them before, but tonight I wanted to come on, and I'm not going to be getting into any news. I don't have any emails or anything. Tonight, I'm just going to be reading from William Branley's The Gods of Eden. I thought where we left off last night, I really wanted to see where it was going next, and so, because I haven't read this either, so I'm just as anxious to see what's going to happen next as you are, so. Tonight, we'll be reading from that here on the broadcast, and we'll be going through some of the various topics here. Chapter 7 of the book, Jehovah, whatever you want to, however you want to say it. And so we'll be doing that and going over the various informations here in William Branley's book, The Gods of Eden. Thanks to everybody who tuned in tonight over there for 3 hours on Live Free Die Radio with Lee Rogers and myself. It was a fantastic show. And fantastic listenership tonight over there on that show as well. I thought it was a good show. I thought we got out some really good important information. We got into a lot of topics tonight, everything from what's going on in Japan to New Madrid earthquake to the rock wall and just all kinds of stuff. So definitely check that show out. It'll be repeating on the stream tonight after the end of this broadcast here for you this evening. So. Crank up that coffee, crank up anything you need, crank up the radio for sure if you don't crank up anything else, and tune in here tonight and join us for this late night Moonbat edition as we will be reading from William Branley's The Gods of Eden tonight. So the chat room is open as usual. Lots of chatters in there tonight hanging out and talking in the room and in having a good time in there. So. Definitely go in there and say hi and hang out with the other listeners and chatters tonight in the chat room. And we've got a lot of good people in there tonight. So should definitely be fun. Yeah. Like I said, I was anxious to get back into reading more of this stuff. And after doing 3 hours over there tonight, generally after doing 3 hours, I'm totally exhausted, but tonight it was good. So we're going to jump into reading the book here for you this evening. Chapter 7. Jehovah, out of William Branley's The Gods of Eden. Much of the Old Testament is devoted to describing the origins and early history of the Hebrew people. According to the Bible, the Hebrews descended from a clan which lived in the Sumerian city of Ur around 2000 to 15,000 BC. The clan was befriended and ruled by a personality named Jehovah. The Bible claims Jehovah was God. According to the biblical narrative, Jehovah encountered the clan to leave Ur and settle in Haran, a caravan center in northeastern Mesopotamia. There, Jehovah later told the clan's new patriarch, Abraham, to lead his tribe on a migration towards Egypt. The tribe compiled, and over the ensuing generations, it slowly made its way through Canaan towards the Nile River. Starvation finally forced the tribe to enter the Egyptian region of Goshen when the Hebrews at first lived well under the Pharaoh. But upon the coming of a new king to the Egyptian throne, the Hebrews were forced into slavery. The Bible states that after 400 years of servitude in Egypt, the Hebrews were led on an exodus out of Egypt by Moses under the watchful eye of Jehovah. By that time, the Hebrews numbered in the hundreds of thousands. After a long trek and many bloody battles, the Hebrew tribes returned to and conquered Canaan, which was the promised land pledged to them centuries earlier by Jehovah. And so, according to the Bible, was born the Jewish religion. Jehovah was clearly an important character in this biblical story. Who was he? Was Jehovah God, as the Bible alleges? Was he a myth, as skeptics with a secular orientation would have us believe? Jehovah appears to have been neither. The name Jehovah comes from the Hebrew word Yahweh, meaning he that is, or the self-evident. This appellation conveys the idea that the biblical Jehovah was a pure spiritual being, a true supreme being, if you will. But was he? Old Testament descriptions of Jehovah have provided a field day for UFO riders, and for good reason. Jehovah traveled through the sky in what appears to have been a noisy, smoking aircraft. A biblical description of Jehovah landing on a mountaintop describes him in this way. There were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount, and the sound of the trumpet was exceedingly loud. And all of the people that were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the lower part of the mountain. And Mount Sinai was altogether covered with smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke from the fire billowed upwards like that of the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. Now, the motherfucking mothership just landed on top of the goddamn mountain. Hello! If an ancient Hebrew were to observe the rumbling smoke and flame of a modern rocket ship, the description would not have been much different than this biblical narrative of Jehovah. A later visit by Jehovah contained the same phenomenon. And all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoke, and the people saw it, and they moved away and stood far off. Genesis 20:18. Lest it be assumed that these descriptions might be of a volcano, further sightings reveal that Jehovah was a moving object. And the Lord traveled before them, them being the Hebrew tribes. And the Lord traveled before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them the way, by night in a pillar of fire to give them light to go by day and night. He took not away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from in front of the people. Exodus 13:21-22. Exodus 14:24, 40:34-38, and Numbers 19:1-23 contain identical descriptions of Jehovah as he led the Hebrew tribes to the promised land. The ancient Hebrew eyewitnesses responsible for the above descriptions were not able to get a closer look at Jehovah. The Bible points out that no one was permitted to approach Jehovah's mountaintop landing sites except Moses and a few select leaders. Jehovah had threatened to kill anyone else who tried. The early Bible therefore contains only descriptions of Jehovah as eyewitnesses saw him from a distance. It was not until much later that one of the Bible's most famous prophets, Ezekiel, was able to get a closer look and describe Jehovah in greater detail. Ezekiel's description is probably the most often quoted biblical passage in UFO literature. Right, yeah, Ezekiel's wheel. Ezekiel's detailed account of strange aerial objects has created speculation of intensity that even one Bible publisher, Tyndale House, prefaced in its introduction to the book of Ezekiel with the title, Dry Bones and Flying Saucers. At the risk of boring some readers with yet another repetition of Ezekiel's famous words, I reproduce them here for the benefit of those who are not familiar with them. And yeah, I'm not going to read that either, because you all should, you know, Ezekiel 1:125, you can look that up on your own. But yeah, it's Ezekiel's wheel, essentially. You all know, I don't think anybody doubts that he's talking about a fucking UFO there. It's pretty undeniable. The voice told Ezekiel that it was the Lord God. The first portion of Ezekiel's vision resembles earlier biblical transcriptions of Jehovah and and all jumbled here. The first portion of Ezekiel's vision resembles earlier biblical descriptions of Jehovah, a moving fiery object in the sky emitting smoke. As the object moved closer, Ezekiel was able to observe that the thing was made of metal. Out of the metal object emerged several human-like creatures, apparently wearing metal boots and ornamented helmets. Their wings appeared to be retractable engines, which emitted a rumbling sound and helped the creatures to fly. Their heads were covered by glass or something transparent that reflected the sky above. Yeah, there's people in spacesuits, for God's sakes. They appeared to be in some sort of circular vehicle or a vehicle with wheels. We can safely conclude that from the above passage that Jehovah was not a supreme being. He appears to have been a succession of custodial management teams operating over a time span for many human generations. To enforce human obedience, those teams used their aircraft to perpetuate the lie that they were God. The custodial teams, known as Jehovah, helped the Brotherhood of the Snake embark on a program of conquest to spread the new one God religion. And that's where Judaism came from, folks. That's what the whole priest class is hiding. I mean, this is what I was talking about tonight with Lee. I mean, this is how much of the stuff that, you know, we were talking about tonight that really seals the deal on the info we were talking about. I mean, this of what we're reading really explains all of the unanswered questions that people have had for the longest time and exactly why the importance of exposing these priest class minions in the Truth Movement and Patriot Movement that are serving as gatekeepers to keep this information from us. They're working on behalf of these priest class bozos. That's what all this Jesuit connection stuff is all about. That's why it's important. They're the ones hiding this info. Moses, the man chosen to command the Hebrew tribes on their exodus out of Egypt to the Promised Land, was a high-ranking member of the Brotherhood. One hint of this fact comes from the Bible itself, in which we are told how Moses was raised as a child. In which time Moses was born and was exceedingly fair and was raised in his father's house for 3 months. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and raised him as her own son. And Moses became learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and in deeds. Egyptian historian and high priest Manetho states that Moses received much of his education in the Brotherhood under Akhenaten, the very Pharaoh who pioneered monotheism. Moses is a son of the tribe of Levi. Yeah, the Levites, the Levite tribes, that's the white brotherhood, the white priests. That's exactly what these guys in charge today, and that's exactly what these guys working for, working in the Truth Movement, Patriot Movement. You understand? This is why these guys are working with these priest-class bozos and trying to cover their asses and cover the asses of the priest-class bozos and the CMP and the John Birch Society and all the rest of this stuff. This is why they're doing that. Because again, this goes back to the Levite tribes, the white priests. That's why you have these white nationalists running around in this. Folks, whether they know it or not, they are serving the white brotherhood that goes back to these ancient custodians that have tricked us into believing their God since time immemorial. That's what's going on here. Moses, the son of the tribe of Levi, attended and educated in Egypt, was initiated at Heliopolis and became a high priest of the Brotherhood of the reign of Pharaoh Akhenaten. He was elected by the Hebrews as their chief, and he adopted to the ideas of his people and the science and philosophy which he had obtained in the Egyptian mysteries. Proofs of this are to be found in the symbols in the initiations and in his precepts and commandments. The dogma of an only God, which he taught with the Egyptian Brotherhood interpretation, and teaching of the Pharaoh who established the first monotheistic religion known to man. Strong evidence in support of Manetho's statement is found in the early teachings of Judaism, which were deeply mystical and utilized many brotherhood symbols. Many of those mystical teachings are still taught today in the Jewish Kabbalah, a secret religious philosophy of Jewish rabbis. The Kabbalah continues to utilize a complex array of mystical symbols. Modern Israel's national logo, the six-pointed Star of David, has been a brotherhood symbol for thousands of years. Early human writers often portrayed mankind's custodial gods as bloodthirsty creatures prone to excessive violence. Well, there you go. You know, Kabbalah coming from these ancient Jewish rabbis, And we talked about tonight on Lee's show about the, you know, these guys sucking the blood out of the foreskin of the circumcised penis. Well, there you go. That's why. I mean, Judaism, Christianity, this all came from the custodians, folks. These traditions of, you know, sucking the blood out of the penis and stuff, that comes from these custodians, these bloodthirsty bastards. Early human writers often portray mankind's custodian gods as bloodthirsty creatures prone to excessive violence. Sadly, those lamentable qualities did not improve with Jehovah during the trek from Egypt to the Promised Land. Jehovah demanded unflagging obedience from the Hebrews. Many humans rebelled, and Jehovah reacted with extreme cruelty. He reportedly killed up to 14,000 Hebrews at a time for disobedience. He used a variety of killing methods, such as spreading diseases, just as other custodial gods had done earlier in Samaria. When the Hebrew armies reached Canaan, Jehovah displayed a genuinely psychopathic bent. To establish the Hebrews in their new homeland, Jehovah ordered the Hebrew armies to embark on a campaign of genocide to depopulate all of the region's existing cities and towns. Under the new leadership of a man named Joshua, the first city to fall in Jehovah's seven-year Holocaust was Jericho. According to the Bible, the Hebrew army, numbering in the tens of thousands, slaughtered everyone in Jericho except, ironically, a prostitute because she had earlier betrayed her own people by helping two Hebrew spies. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword, Joshua 6:21. After that was accomplished, they burnt the city with fire and all that was therein, only the silver and the gold and the vessels of brass and iron they put in the treasury of the house of the Lord. Right. Yeah. Going to kill everybody and take, make sure you get that silver and gold out there. Yeah. You don't think the custodians were had a hand in that deal, do you? Gold mining sons of bitches. The next target was Ai, a city with a population of 12,000 inhabitants. All of the citizens were butchered and the city was burned to the ground. This savagery was perpetrated city after city. The genocide was justified by saying that the victims were all wicked. This could not have been the true reason because children and animals were also slaughtered. It is hardly fair to massacre an entire city for the crimes of a few. Neither is it right to murder a child for the crimes of its parents. The real crime, according to the Bible, was that the natives of the region had become disobedient. They were more obedient Hebrew. The more obedient Hebrews were therefore elected by Jehovah to wipe out the natives and replace them. Well, that's, believe it or not, that's what they want to do to this day. It's these same bastards running the show. I mean, what do you think these guys, you know, Jews killing Jews, you know, well, you had the Ashkenazis funding Hitler to exterminate the Sephardic Jews. I mean, what do you think that was? I mean, they call all of us that aren't them goyim. It's sick, man. There is some debate today about whether the Hebrew assimilation into Canaan was as genocidal as portrayed in the Bible. Modern archaeological digs into some of the battle sites named in the Bible, such as Hazor, Lachish, and Debir, have revealed evidence of violent destruction during the time of Joshua. Other sites have yielded less conclusive evidence. Many people understandably prefer to play down the biblical bloodshed as much as possible. To whatever degree the biblical story of the conquest of Canaan is true, it does tell us something very important about genocide. Genocide is often a tool for promoting rapid political or social change by quickly replacing one group of people with another. And my God, did they not do that again in Iraq? They're going to do it again in the whole Middle East. Same people. They've been doing this for centuries. Nothing has changed. We're just too goddamn ignorant to see it. Ugh. These same fuckers have been doing this shit for centuries, folks. For this reason, genocide has emerged as a significant historical phenomenon in connection with many brotherhood efforts at bringing about rapid political and social change. People who are familiar with Jewish moral teachings may be surprised at the brutal behavior ascribed to Jehovah and the Hebrews. The most famous of the Jewish moral teachings are, of course, the Ten Commandments, which were reportedly given to Moses by Jehovah during the Hebrews' trek to the Promised Land. After Moses' death, Jehovah and the armies of Israel clearly violated the commandments in a big way. Thou shalt not kill was transgressed when the Hebrews massacred the inhabitants of Canaan. The Hebrews ignored the commandment, thou shalt not steal, when they robbed the dying cities of their precious metals. They were no better about adhering to their commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, or anything that is thy neighbor's, when they committed genocide to take away the land of their neighbors. This behavior is puzzling because many biblical commandments do establish a decent code of conduct. For example, the Hebrews were admonished never to cooperate with a wrongdoer by giving false testimony. Another commandment stressed the importance of individual responsibility in the face of group pressure by stating, you shall not go along with a group in doing evil. Tolerance for outsiders was made law with, you shall not vex a stranger nor oppress him. Thieves are usually required to pay restitution to their victims. How do we account for the existence of such humane commandments in the face of such barbaric behavior? Part of the answer may lie in the words of Manetho. The wonders which Moses narrates as having taken place upon the Mount Sinai, the mountain upon which Jehovah reportedly gave Moses many of the commandments, are in part a veiled account of the Egyptian initiation which Moses transmitted to his people when he established a branch of the Egyptian Brotherhood in his country. If Manetho's words are true, then many of the commandments may have come from human sources within the Brotherhood rather than from custodial sources. That is key. That's key because I was hinting about that on Lee's show tonight, the idea that, you know, these guys, these priests that had this ancient knowledge at some point, you know, I don't agree that they said, okay, you know, you're supposed to take this knowledge, keep it for yourself, and then, you know, keep the people in ignorance. That's not what it indicates. It indicates that once the priests realized how much power they had, it was that they could assume power over the whole planet if they used that information in secret, kept up in ignorance, and only used it to further their plan and their agenda. And that's exactly what they've done to a T. This is all relevant to everything that's going on. This is just as important as the news or anything else, folks. Because if we don't understand this, they can pull off every false flag terror event, every tsunami, every earthquake, everything they want to do, and it still won't matter because we have been too distracted by the bullshit to look at the information that the bullshit artists have told us is a distraction. It's unfucking believable. This is the info that we all should have been looking at for the longest time because it explains the entire quote-unquote New World Order system. This would indicate the continued presence of genuine humanitarians within the Brotherhood despite custodial dominance. Moses himself appears to have been at least to some degree such a humanitarian. The Bible describes Moses as a man of moderation who frequently intervened on behalf of the Hebrews when Jehovah was about to mete out a violent punishment. As we shall see several times in this book, lingering humanitarian influences within the Brotherhood have often come to the surface, but sadly not enough to entirely undo the corrupting influences. Another puzzling aspect of the biblical genocide story was the behavior of the people being slaughtered. According to the Bible, only one city surrendered. The rest chose to fight and be butchered. When confronted with an overpowered Hebrew army, and perhaps even a thundering God in the sky, it is not likely that more besieged cities would surrender or at least offer to vacate Canaan peaceably. The Bible presents an interesting explanation of why that did not happen. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon, and all others they took in battle. For it was the Lord who had hardened their hearts, they would go against Israel in battle that he might destroy them utterly and that they might find no favor and that he might destroy them. The above passage states that Jehovah had manipulated the victims' people into fighting the Hebrews so that the victims could be destroyed. This is a stunning and important admission, for it would imply that Jehovah or other custodians dominated other cities in the region and used their influence to manipulate people into fighting the Hebrews. And my God, what have they done ever since, folks? These same custodial bastards are the ones that are trying to use their influence to manipulate people in the Truth Movement and Patriot Movement to want a violent conflict against the government now. Can't you see this? Yeah, that's a stunning and important admission. My God! That's like the first admission of what people call false flag, isn't it? You goad this group over here into fighting, so when they get ready to fight, you can crush them. That's the whole plan they're trying to institute now with the teabaggers and the patriots and all this shit. The same fucking people running these priest class bozos. Unfucking believable. The Bible reports similar manipulations in an earlier episode when the Hebrews were still slaves in Egypt. Jehovah had instructed Moses to go to the Pharaoh to ask that the Hebrew tribes be freed. Jehovah, however, had influence over the Pharaoh, and Moses had been warned in advance that Jehovah would cause the Pharaoh to say no. According to the Bible, Jehovah had a definite reason for manipulating the Pharaoh in that fashion. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his servants, that I might show my powers before him. And so that you may tell in the ears of your son and your son's son what things I had brought about in Egypt and my miracles which I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Lord." God, it's unbelievable. When you look at this, I mean, even that statement right there, folks, isn't this an amazing new perspective to look at the Bible from? When you look at this, when you see it from the perspective of this is a trickster, and this is somebody who is tricking people into believing that he's a God so he can control them. My God, everything in the Bible just makes so much more fucking sense, doesn't it? Wow. It's just undeniable. Absolutely undeniable to me. After hearing those words, Moses went to a Pharaoh a number of times to renew his pleas for the Hebrews' freedom. Each plea was rejected, and each rejection was followed by a calamity visited upon the Egyptians by Jehovah. The calamities included vermin infestations, plagues, boils on the skin caused by fine dust settling over the countryside. And people get boils and stuff now. Hell, I had one a year or so ago. People get that stuff now from chemtrails. Imagine that. I mean, it sounds like they're talking about fucking spraying chemtrails on the people back in the day. I mean, hell, they probably were. It would surprise you in the least. I mean, everybody speculated these chemtrails being done by aliens for years anyway. I mean, God, that wouldn't surprise me in the least bit. Listen to that. After hearing those words, Moses went to the Pharaoh a number of times to renew his pleas for the Hebrews. And each plea was rejected, and each rejection was followed by a calamity visited upon the Egyptians by Jehovah. The calamities include vermin infestations, plagues, boils on the skin caused by a fine dust settling over the countryside. My goodness. That sounds like they're spraying chemtrails. And finally, the murder of each eldest son in Egypt during a night known as the Passover. It was only after the Passover that Jehovah stopped hardening the heart of the Pharaoh so that the Hebrew tribes could leave Egypt. Many scholars would argue that the biblical references to Jehovah hardening the hearts of Israel's enemies merely expresses the religious idea that all human thought and emotion come ultimately from God, and therefore such writing should not be taken literally. In this case, we should take the Bible seriously because it has described a very real political phenomenon, two or more parties being manipulated into conflict with one another by an outside third party. One of the most famous philosophers to discuss third-party manipulation as a tool of social and political control was Niccolo Machiavelli, the 16th century philosopher. Although Machiavelli was not the first to write about these matters, his name has become synonymous with unscrupulous political cunning. Machiavelli authored several unsolicited how-to manuals for the benefit of a local prince. Those writings have become literary classics. In them, Machiavelli describes several of the techniques used by various Italian rulers to maintain control over a population. One method was to breed conflict. In his treatise, The Prince, Machiavelli wrote, "Some princes, so as to hold securely the state, have disarmed their subjects, and others have kept their subjects' towns distracted by factions and disputes." Machiavelli cited a specific example. "Our forefathers and those who were reckoned wise were accustomed to say that it was necessary to hold factions and fortresses, and with this idea, they fostered quarrels in some of the tributary towns so as to keep them in possession of them more easily. Divide and conquer. They divide and conquer these little towns against each other so they can could control both of them. That's what they do now with the left-right political spectrum. That's what they do with teabaggers versus, you know, liberals and all this shit. They've never changed their plan. They've never deviated once. They've been executing this for centuries. It's mind-boggling even to me, somebody who's been looking at this information for half their life, to now be sitting here reading this and really understanding that. I mean, I've known it, but it's just undeniable anymore. These people have never deviated. And we're so goddamn stupid and just powerless, because the only thing that gives these people power, and I've said this for the longest time too on the show, and those of you who have been listening for the longest time will back me up on this. I've said this for the longest time. The secret knowledge, the hidden knowledge is the key, is the absolute key and answer to unlocking everything, because it unlocks the secrets of our potential, and our potential is what will be the elite's undoing. And that's it. With that, I put it off for so long. I put it off forever. That's it. Bottoms up. I'm going all in on this. As soon as Secret Right Volume 2 is coming out, I'm going forward with my secret knowledge film. I'm going to put what I believe to be the best greatest hits collection of the secret knowledge into a DVD film, and I'm going to put it out there. It's time. And I knew it was time about a year or two ago, but God damn it, after this, now I'm for sure know that it's time. That's what I'm doing for my next project. It's time. That's what I was put on this planet to do, and by God, I'm going to do it. Human disunity was a valuable commodity to the prince because it made the people less able to mount a challenge. Machiavelli described the exact steps to be taken by anyone wishing to employ this tool. The way to set about this is to win the confidence of the city, which is disunited, and so long as they do not come to blows, to act as an arbitrator between the parties, and when they come to blows, to give tardy support to the weaker party, both with a view to keeping them at it and wearing them out, and again, because stronger measures would leave no room for any doubt that you were out to subjugate them and make yourself their ruler. When this scheme is carried out, it will happen, as always, that in the end you have in view will be attained. The city of Pistoia, as I have said in another discourse, and apropos of another topic, was acquired by the Republic of Florence by just such an artifice. For it was divided, and the Florentines supported now one, now the other party, and without making themselves obnoxious to either, led them on until they got sick of their turbulent way of living, and they then came to throw themselves voluntarily into the arms of Florence. Despite the effectiveness of this technique, Machiavelli advised against using it because it can backfire on the perpetrator. The success of the technique depends upon at least one of the manipulated parties not being aware of the true source of the problem. If both parties should discover that they are being manipulated into hostilities by an outside third party, not only will those hostilities usually cease, but the parties will more often than not unite in a common dislike for the perpetrator. That's exactly what I'm telling you we've got to do with exposing the CMP information and the Jesuits and the phony patriots and all of this stuff. Because when everybody sees how they've been lied to on both sides by the truthers and the patriots and the teabaggers and the lefties over here, when they finally see that this has all been a part of a great plan to divide everybody, left, right, everything else, all people will have no choice but to unite against the power elite. This is the kind of revolution I've been talking about, and it doesn't require violence. It is the revolution of the mind. This phenomenon can be observed on a personal level when two friends discover that a third friend has been saying derogatory things about each one to the other behind their backs. Yeah, classic back shit talking. We wonder why everybody does that. It's fucking programmed into us by these goddamn custodial bastards. Hey, I got a custodial job for you, motherfucker. Go clean the shit out of my toilet. There's a custodial job for you. You fucking clowns are going down. It's over. Pack your shit up. I don't even know why you guys still try. It's over for you. Mankind is not going to be defeated. Pack it up. For the technique to be effective, the perpetrator must remain hidden from view as the source of the conflict. To summarize the observations of Machiavelli, we find that breeding conflict between people can be an effective tool for maintaining social and political control over a populace. For the technique to be effective, the instigator must do the following. Number one, erect conflicts and issues which will cause people to fight among themselves rather than against the perpetrator. God. Yep. Well, you know, that's the whole thing for me, though. I read Machiavelli, The Prince, several years ago. And it's in, yeah, I mean, that's what it is. It's the blueprint for divide and conquer. Number two, remain hidden from the view as a true instigator of the conflicts. Three, lend support to all warring parties. And four, be viewed as the benevolent source which can solve the conflicts. As noted earlier in the Tower of Babel story, the custodial gods wanted to keep mankind disunited and under custodial control. To accomplish this, the biblical story of Jehovah indicates that custodians implemented the Machiavellian technique of creating factionalism between human beings. Let's see where I left off here. The Bible states that the custodians encourage the factions they control to battle one another. All the while, the custodians have proclaimed themselves the God and angels to whom people should turn in order to find a solution to all the warfare. This is the classic sequence straight out of Machiavelli. For such Machiavellian efforts to remain successful over a long period of time, factionalism would need to be bred constantly by the custodians, and they would need to remain permanently hidden from view as the perpetrators. And that's exactly what they've done by having these cover groups. That's why they have always put out the things. See, folks, this is why my point is proven, that the priest class are the real controllers. They put the Jews out as their front group to take the blame. This, what we have been reading tonight, proves that 100%, because it shows that they were tricking the Hebrews into believing that they were their gods and getting them to do their bidding. And that's exactly why the custodians have used the Jews as the front men for all their operations. And the priest class is staying hidden. And Alex Jones and the Truth Movement and the Patriot Movement and the white nationalists and all you motherfuckers out there. This is the final straw. This is the one that broke the camel's back. We now realize this beyond any shadow of a doubt. Oh my God. There it is right there, folks. That lays it all out. The Jews have been their front men, have been their scapegoat, have been their fall guy from day one. For such Machiavellian efforts to remain successful over a long period of time, factionalism would need to be bred constantly through the custodians, and they would need to remain permanently hidden from view as the perpetrators. That's what they've done. They've remained permanently hidden from view as the perpetrators until now, because these priests, these ones that control all of these groups, folks, this is them. This is what they've been hiding. This is why Alex Jones has told you for years that talking about extraterrestrials and the Anunnaki and all that stuff was a distraction, and you needed to focus on the bankers. No, don't look over here what the priest class is doing. No, don't worry about the CMP. Worry about the CFR. Yeah, why you think that fucking clown's been telling you that lie? So that you never find out this. Both of these needs were met in the organizational structure of the corrupted Brotherhood. The Brotherhood was being forced into a far-flung network of politically powerful secret societies and religions which could successfully organize people into competing factions at the same time. Brotherhood traditions of secrecy effectively disguised its organizational hierarchy, and this secrecy became a screen behind which custodians could hide at the top of the Brotherhood hierarchy behind veils of myth and thereby obscure their role as instigators of violent conflict among human beings. My God. There's another one. Another just monumental fucking paragraph right there. The secrecy became a screen behind which the custodians could hide at the top. That's why for years and years and years, everybody, you know, they go up the food chain. They find the Bilderbergers, they find the bankers, they find the Rothschilds. And then when they get up to a certain point, you hit a brick wall. You can't figure out, you can tell there's another top of the power structure, but you can't find out who it is. For years, we've all had that problem in the research community. Well, that sentence right there tells you why. The secrecy of the secret societies became a screen behind which custodians could hide at the top of the Brotherhood hierarchy, behind the veils of the myths, and the myths are the things that they tell in the secret societies. They're hiding behind that and thereby obscure their role as instigators of violent conflict between human beings. We are at war because they put us at war, not because we want to fight other human beings. We all know that. This book is great because it really wraps up and puts everything that I've known to be the truth in a way that's just undeniable. I mean, I only know all this stuff to be true because all my years and years in research have told me all of these things, but the way that this is being presented like this, it's just taking everything that I've ever read about and learned about and filling in all the blanks. And especially with the CMP stuff and that we've been exposing, my goodness, man, it is an unbelievable feeling for me to know that I am doing exactly, I'm following my path, man. I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing in this life. That's a very, it's just an unbelievable thing. I feel so lucky because not a lot of people get a chance to do that, especially in our society. And I've never given up on the times of my life when my life sucked. And I didn't see any way out of it, you know. But I always knew that if I kept on pushing and I kept on just surviving and living, that eventually the path of my life would present itself to me. And it has. In this fashion, the network of brotherhood organizations became the primary channel through which wars between human beings could be secretly and continuously generated by the custodial society, thereby carrying out the custodial intentions announced in the Tower of Babel story. The brotherhood also became the channel through which the custodial institutions could be imposed upon the human race. Wars serve another custodial purpose revealed in the Bible. The Adam and Eve story mentioned God's intention to make physical survival an all-consuming chore from birth until death. Well, they've effectively done that. Wars help bring this about because they absorb large-scale resources and offer little to enhance life in return. Wars tear down and destroy what has already been created. This makes a great deal of extra effort necessary just to maintain a culture. The more a society engages in building war machines and fighting wars, the more the people of that society will find their lives consumed in tedium and repetitious toil because of the parasitic and destructive nature of war. This is as true today as it was in 1000 BC. I couldn't agree with that statement more. It is easily observed that the people will fight and quarrel without any outside prompting. There is hardly a creature on earth that does not at some point in its life attack another. One clearly does not need a manipulative third party for a dispute to arise between groups of people. Third parties simply cause disputes and conflicts to be more frequent, severe, and protracted. Spontaneous, uninfluenced fights tend to be quick, awkward, and centered around a single visible dispute. The way to keep fighting artificially alive is to create unresolvable issues, which can only be settled by the complete annihilation of one of the opponents and then by helping the opposing team sustain their struggle against one another by equalizing their fighting strengths. Every war ever fought right there. To keep a whole race in a constant state of strife, issues over which members of the race will fight one another must be generated continuously, and fervent warriors must be bred to fight for those causes, just like they did with Al-Qaeda. I mean, everything should be making a lot more sense to you now, folks, no matter what level of this information you're at, whether you're a noob or an advanced person or, you know, a long-term veteran or a short-term person that's been looking at this stuff for a few years. This should really make things a lot more clear for you now. You know what I mean? These are the precise types of conflicts which have been created by the Brotherhood Network all the way up until today. These artificial conflicts have embroiled the human race in the unrelieved morass of wars which have so blighted human history. Detecting Brotherhood involvement in human events is sometimes tricky. The job is made easier by following the use of several of the Brotherhood's most important mystical symbols. Those symbols act as colored threads weaving in and out of the view by which we can trace the old of the Brotherhood Network in shaping history. One of the most significant of the symbols is, curiously, an apron. So we're going to leave it right there for tonight. Wanted to come on and at least do a chapter with you guys tonight because I had to 3 hours over there with Lee Rogers tonight. Didn't have a live show, but man, oh man, oh man, oh man, what a damn chapter that was with chapter 7 of William Bramley's Gods of Eden tonight. My goodness. Well, I'm glad I came and did that too. I know it's a short show tonight, but my voice is kind of racked. I'm sure you can tell. I talked for almost 4 hours tonight, so I'm done for the night. But man, what a chapter that was. Great, great info. I'm just blown away. I mean, I've got a lot to think about now too after tonight, and I hope you do as well. This is an important broadcast. I'm sure some of our friends will put it up on YouTube and stuff, but I think the reading of this has been an important broadcast because, man, doesn't it really wrap up all the suspicions and everything that we already know from years and years and looking at documents and years of looking at the news and the wars? I mean, this really explains everything pretty well, doesn't it? It makes everything make total sense, folks. This is really it. I mean, if we can find a way to get this information in the hands of more people, we could change some things around. And I'd made that mission, to do that a couple of years ago, but I've been so busy, you know, concentrating on the importance of this CMP thing and getting the C-Right 2 out that I sort of put that on the back burner. Well, not anymore. I want to go fucking balls deep in exposing the rock wall and the ancient secret knowledge. I want to do it all. Let's do it all. The only person that can decide that you can or can't do it all is yourself. So let's just do it all. Let's expose it all. Let's go after these bastards. The time is now. The world belongs to us. Let's take it back. Support our work. Please go to the Chip and Banner. Use the Chip and Banner there to help us pay the bills for the month. Also, use the donate button if you want to support the work, the films, the music. Help us buy more gear, whatever else. I have to eat, live, and survive. We don't have commercials, nothing else. Please support our work, folks. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. We'll see you next time. You guys have a great one. Take care.